This is the Patriots All 22 podcast on the CLNS Media Network, the leading online provider for the six-time Super Bowl champion New England Patriots.
Welcome into a new edition of the Patriots All 22 podcast, powered by the CLNS Media Podcast Network. I am Evan Lazar, and I am joined today by Travis Wingfield of Locked On Dolphins. He hosts the podcast, he's a lead writer, he does it all. And Travis is great. You can go follow him on Twitter at WingfieldNFL. He takes a very similar approach to myself, I like to think, and in a more of like an X's and O's and film analysis type thing. So definitely go follow him. The Patriots do play the Dolphins twice a year, so it's always good to keep tabs. Travis, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, no problem, Evan. I appreciate you having me on. I really enjoyed your Brian Flores episode with me back in January. A lot of fans loved that podcast, so I appreciate that. And when you mentioned the film study and the similar approach, I'm kind of jealous of you, man, because the last couple of days you've been pumping out all these great breakdowns, and that's like not what we're doing right now in Miami because no one cares about the season. So I'm like watching all these great film breakdowns on Twitter. I'm like, oh man, I'm missing out. So we'll see what happens Sunday, but I'm looking forward to talking to you about this game, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously in New England, we have a bigger story than this game, unfortunately, going on with Antonio Brown right now. But I really needed to talk some football and get into some real football talk. And even though the Dolphins obviously had a rough week one, you can never take any opponent lightly, and especially going down to Miami, where the Patriots have not had the best record, lost five of the last six. Brady, I think, is 7-11 in his career is the statistic in Miami. So for whatever reason, Travis, it's a house of horrors down there for the Patriots. And it starts, and ends kind of with the Miami Miracle last year is that was one of the most incredible plays I've ever seen, obviously. And at that point, I think that a lot of Patriots fans and even the team itself, I think Tom Brady even kind of hinted at this, is like, are we just cursed in that stadium? Like, is there just something going on with that? I mean, can you put your finger on what makes Miami successful against the Pats down there?
I mean, for a team that is always prepared for every situation and they're always so uniform about their approach in terms of having guys, just take the profession seriously and the whole do your job mantra, you would think that the South Beach vibe wouldn't entice a team like that, but maybe that's what it is, because I can't explain it for myself. You mentioned the Miami Miracle, a team that prides itself on being prepared for every single situation in a game, and you wind up with Rob Gronkowski as the deep safety on a play that has to go, what was it, 69 yards, which is hilariously fitting, by the way, that it was Gronk on a 69-yard play. But I don't know what it is. I really don't. I mean, usually the game's in December, and I feel like it's the annual Patriots wake-up call. You go back to 2014, it was the opening day game, and you could probably kind of attribute some of that to the heat and humidity, and no Sean Marino had a lot of success that day, but I don't think there's anything special about it. It's just one of those weird oddities that you can't explain, I think, Evan.
Yeah, you bring up the time of year that they usually play there, and I think that there's kind of this notion among Patriots fans that they play a lot of games down there in September, which actually isn't the case. They've only played two games with Brady in Miami in September. They're 1-1, one of them being the Troy Brown overtime game.
No. I
had to bring it up. And the other one in the 2014 Revis game, which is, we know it as a lot as Patriots fans know it as the Revis game because it's his first game as a Patriot. And for whatever reason, they decided that the best game plan in that game was to play a lot of zone coverage. So they had Revis out there in zone coverage, the best man coverage corner of his era, playing zone. And he looked lost as hell and just didn't know where he was going. And it wasn't, they lost the game, and everybody in 2014, they obviously corrected, righted the ship and went on to win the Super Bowl. But everybody was kind of expecting that team to be, 15-1, 14-2, and, get off to this amazing start and maybe be 8 or 9-0 to begin the season, a lot like this team this year. And it didn't happen that way, obviously, at the week one loss. So I think that it just seems to be a house of horrors. And I know a lot of Patriots fans also are afraid because that's where the Super Bowl is this year. And if there's like any carryover, maybe it's just the Dolphins, maybe it's like just the
first world problems, man.
It's not Hard Rock Stadium. First world problems is right. Let's get into this Dolphins team though. I know, they didn't have a good week one. That's obviously, everybody knows about that. But I do want to talk about some of the things that not only that they did well, but a lot of listeners, I'm sure, are very familiar with the coaching staff down there in Miami now, obviously. So let's start with Flores and just your I just want to get your general impressions of kind of how the Flores era has begun here, because it's been a little bit rocky. But from some things that I've heard, it's also been some positive things.
I think you kind of have to think about what other Belichick disciples, for lack of a better term, have kind of gone through in terms of trying to establish their own culture and their own program. And that's one thing that Brian Flores is really trying to do down here. But at the same time, you have this ultimate, like, competing dichotomy of this team wants to not win games. They really don't want to win games this year, Evan. Like, I know it sounds crazy to say, but to go out and have all these draft picks, and if you don't have to use them to trade up and you can get a Tua Tagovailoa, it would just serve the future of this team so much better than going 6-10 for the, you know, eighth time this decade or whatever it is. And so you have that competing within the organizational structure of the front office. And then you have the coaching staff, who obviously wants to compete and line up every single play and win these plays. And Brian Flores has to find a way to meld those two messages and convey it to the public. And he's really in a lose-lose situation, because he's trying to say, we're not tanking. And then you have the beat writer saying, well, why is he telling us this, when it's very clear they are tanking the season. So he's stuck in this really awkward position. And you kind of wonder, like, is he going to be able to survive, you know, 49-point beatdowns every week? That's not going to be the case, but that was not a competitive team we saw on Sunday. And the thing that I keep going back to is that he was of the eight coaches that got hired this offseason, he's the only one that got 5 years fully guaranteed. So I feel like there is a backing with Stephen Ross and the organization behind Brian Flores, but, man, he couldn't start off any worse than what he has right now.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing that surprises me about their approach is that, coming from a Belichick, you know, disciple, as you said, to obviously it's not maybe not his decision, maybe it's going above his head to tank for Tua, so to speak, but that just goes against everything that he's learned in his entire career as a head coach, because Bill Belichick has said many a times that his worst nightmare is to have a 2-14 season. Like, he's not going to let that happen. And the Patriots are not an organization that ever plans, under Belichick at least, that will ever plan on tanking. You know, that's just not something that they're ever going to do. I remember in 2012, was it, when the Colts didn't have Peyton Manning sitting out that year. And Belichick actually, I don't remember what kind of documentary it was or whatever, or maybe he was asked about it by a reporter, said that they would never put themselves in that position, that they would have a quarterback that could at least be serviceable behind the starter, behind Brady, you know, presumably, to be able to at least get them to 11-5, 10-6, 8-8, whatever the record may be. Like Matt Castle, exactly. And they had no desire to tank whatsoever in any circumstances. So that's what surprises me so much about Flores. And also Greer is a, you know, not, you gotta go ways back to get to his Patriots ties, but he's, you know, not that far removed from that organization either. So it does shock me that Flores, I'm sure it's driving Flores and Chad O'Shea crazy that they're not, that they have them in the situation that they have them in. And it's a bummer to me too, because both of those guys did it the right way. They worked their way up, and O'Shea's been extremely patient, in particular behind Josh McDaniels, kind of waiting for his chance to run his own offense. And now he's got the chance, and this is what the cards he's kind of been dealt with.
And you kind of feel like it's ownership driven, because the worst thing that could have happened to this Dolphins team was to have Lamar Jackson show up, the South Florida native, and throw for 5 touchdowns, a perfect passer rating, on and on and on. Because you recall the 2018 draft when they got Minka Fitzpatrick, who wasn't supposed to be on the board at the 11th pick at that point in the draft. And Stephen Ross threw a fit and left the draft room because he wanted to trade down and target Lamar Jackson with extra picks and, of course, a cheaper contract by falling down the rung in the first round of the draft. Well, he comes back, the scouting staff wins that debate, so to speak, and then Lamar Jackson comes back in the first game against the Dolphins and just shoves it right up there, you know what. And so now he's thinking, okay, well, I'm the big swinging you know what, if so to speak, and I'm going to make this decision, this mandate, to go ahead and go after a guy that I absolutely love, a guy that beat the brakes off of Oklahoma in the, I think it was the Orange Bowl, last playoffs in the college football playoffs at his stadium at Hard Rock. And so he was there, he saw that, he knows all about Tua and the decorated career that he's had so far at Alabama. But when you think back to kind of Brian Flores' message about why he took this job, he told us, and who knows if he's telling the truth, but he told us that the reason he took this job was because his vision with Stephen Ross and the organization was entirely aligned. And so that vision has to include tanking, right? Because that's what they're doing. And it's very clear that that's the mandate. And so if that vision was aligned, and he said that he had other interviews last year and this year, and he was going to turn down jobs unless those visions aligned with his. So I don't know. What you say makes a lot of sense. What he says is different. I have no idea what's true and what's not.
Yeah, and like a true Belichick disciple, he is very good at playing the PR game. So that's a big part of it, too. So what you're telling me, though, is that we're going to be in a division next year with a 43-year-old Tom Brady, Tua Tagovailoa, Josh Allen, and Sam Darnold. I mean, that it'll be fun, if anything. I we'll see what happens. But that is kind of Tua or Justin Herbert or one of these guys seems like destined to be a Miami Dolphin, and Brady's going to be like 30 years older than all these guys and still out there. Schematically, I wanted to talk about, obviously the familiarity and just, what have you seen? Let's start on defense with Flores. I know you studied a little bit of Patriots defensive film when they made the hire. Have you kind of seen him carry over a lot of that stuff?
Yeah, we saw plenty of it in the practices, and it's difficult to gauge off that one game because it was pretty much a neck breaker type of game going up and down the field. So we didn't really get a great look at the type of situational calls they want to make outside of a few drives when the game was still competitive because it got out of hand in the first quarter. So you look back to training camp, though, and it was a lot of the stuff you see from the Patriots, 4-3 under fronts, the 3-3-5 bear package where you're going to have the linebackers come down off the edge and what looks like basically a 6-1 look. You're going to have a lot of sub packages in the secondary with dime defense. But the major difference with this Dolphins team and the Patriots, which as you can tell by the scoreboard, is that they're just short on bodies, and particularly in the secondary, where this team, just like Belichick does, wants to run a lot of dime defense when the offense gets behind the chains. They want to usher out defensive backs onto the field, but whereas the Patriots have 10, 11 guys that are capable of contributing on defense, Miami has, 3 or 4, 5 at best. And so they're not fully capable of running the packages that he wants to run. The blitz concepts, again, we saw in the preseason with a lot of the contain rush type of stuff and, throwing linebackers in the A gaps or off the edge or whatever you're going to do like Dont'a Hightower does. But in the game, it was different because Lamar Jackson is such a unique quarterback that you kind of have to change what you do. And they dared him to beat them deep, and boy, did he. He got after him on the deep pass, and they really wanted to commit bodies into the running game, fit every gap and fill with the linebackers. And they did that, and they brought the safeties down, but then they left their guys one-on-one coverage on the back end, and Hollywood Brown made them pay, Willie Snead made them pay, and Lamar Jackson was just dialed in. So I'm curious to see the plan on Sunday. I think I have to imagine that Flores has a plan that he's got to know, right? Like he has to have an idea of what the Patriots do. So I think the biggest thing we're looking for from Dolphins fans' perspective is, can he just match somewhat close a plan that can compete with Belichick?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think the point about the DBs is the first thing that I noticed is that he was running through a lot of the same coverages that the Patriots run through, and even some zero coverage, which is what he kind of brought to the Pats last year, his own little kind of sprinkle in there when he was de facto defensive coordinator. We can call him the actual defensive coordinator because he was leading meetings and calling plays and, doing that whole thing. But the problem was that for Miami, they don't have a Stephon Gilmore and a Devin McCourty and all these veteran safeties and all these veteran defensive backs in general that have experience in the system and also experience in the league where they can change a lot of structures post-snap. So they were playing zero coverage against Lamar, and it was zero at the start and it was zero at the end. And if you do that against Tom Brady, it's going to be a long day. Again, Tom Brady, the best way other than like, I know a lot of people talk about like the rush 4, drop 7 kind of mentality against Brady, but the best way is actually to confuse his receivers because you're not going to confuse Tom, right? So the best way to kind of get on Brady is to confuse his receivers a little bit and be able to change those pictures post snap. So you show them like a post safety cover 1 look and then you make it quarters, or you make it cover two after the snap, or you make it man when it looks like zone. And that throws off the timing and the option route element of their offense a little bit. And I think that that's kind of like the best way to do it. So I'm very curious to see if Flores can kind of be able to rotate through some coverages a little bit better. Because in this game against Baltimore, Lamar kind of knew what was coming the entire time, it kind of felt like. And that was a big reason why they had so much success against them. On the other side of the ball with Chad O'Shea, again, like I mentioned, a guy that I really think was very well respected in New England, and a lot of people kind of thought of him, if Josh McDaniels did leave eventually, that O'Shea was going to be easily tabbed to kind of the next offensive coordinator of the Pats without any real thinking about it. He ran a lot of Patriots staples, you know, that I noticed at least. Haas-Wyjuke obviously got in there a few times. Some of the Yankee concepts, some of the running plays, a lot of, you know, McDaniels overlaps there for O'Shea.
Yeah, and that's certainly what we saw throughout training camp as well. And you're going to see some wrinkles off of those similar concepts, like you mentioned. I think I told you on Twitter that there was, that play action fake jet sweep with a post to Devontae Parker where the backside crosser comes over and tries to kind of hold that safety. We saw a lot of that in practice, and that they'll throw some wrinkles in off of that too. You mentioned Chad O'Shea having kind of his reputation in New England was based. It was so strong that they made him the coordinator of the red zone packages. And I think the Dolphins had one red zone trip on Sunday, so not a lot to dip into there, but I was impressed overall with kind of the things we saw in practice. I mean, over and over again, they just ran the crap out of the football in practice, and they did it with the multiple types of running schemes, whether it was outside zone, which is kind of a principle of a lot of teams in the NFL today, but they also ran a lot of lead and ISO and power and a lot of 21 personnel, as you guys well know, with James Devlin. They drafted Chandler Cox out of Auburn, and he was kind of a preseason sensation, so to speak. And then they get into this game against Baltimore, and he played three snaps. And I think that a reason for that is the scoreboard obviously dictates what you can do personnel-wise. But I think that what they want to do is be a team that can kind of shorten games and play good defense, which, again, this is all so funny to say because they didn't execute any of it on Sunday. But the idea, the path to victory for this team that is very short on talent, especially when it comes up against the Patriots, is to run the ball and, you know, establish that running game, which, you know, an antiquated way of thinking, but do it that way, play solid defense, win in the red zone, and try to strike a couple of big passing plays, which Fitzpatrick, he did that on Sunday. That's the one thing they actually executed was the deep passing game. But I think we'll see an attempt to try to run the ball and build in those shot plays based off those run looks.
Yeah, and there's some little kind of, I was talking to you about it on Twitter, some, you know, variations that O'Shea ran with some of the jet sweep actions and stuff like that, hitting those plays a little bit faster. Whereas the Patriots like to draw them out a little bit longer and kind of delay the handoff fakes and make the whole thing kind of slow, look like it's in slow motion for like a second or two there. Yeah. And with O'Shea, it was just, you know, it was like NASCAR. It was just let's drive it right now. And I actually really liked it. I thought that it challenged the defense a little bit with a little bit more speed element to it. I wonder if the McDaniels sees that and this week and tries to maybe copy it a little bit there. And I think that the biggest thing that I always see with the 21 personnel and all that kind of stuff, Miami, remember last year, they ran all over the Patriots down in Miami last year with Brandon Bolden and obviously Kenyon Drake being involved a little bit too. So it'll be interesting to see if they go with a similar plan. I know Flores is going to remember that game and be like, that our defense couldn't stop the run last year down here. So maybe they go in that direction again. You mentioned Fitzmagic. Let's talk about Fitzmagic, because I thought after watching that game, he played about as good as you possibly could have by in a blowout like that, you know, and the two things that impressed me the most were the ability to throw the ball downfield, as you hinted at. His accuracy on deep balls was pinpoint. I mean, he was hitting guys right on the hands down the field. And the other thing is his little Houdini acts in the pocket. The Patriots play a ton of man coverage. So if you got a guy that's back there and he's getting out of sacks and he's, you know, getting outside the pocket and extending plays with his legs, that's a long time for those guys to cover downfield. And, you know, what have you seen from Fitzmagic? I know that he's also very capable of having a big game. You know, he's had big games in the past in his career. He's a volatile player. You know, sometimes it can be ugly and sometimes it can be great. I actually thought he was pretty much in the middle against Baltimore, which is interesting.
Yeah, he's not very risk adverse at all. But I wish this was a video podcast for your listeners, because we both got the same smirk when you mentioned Fitzmagic. He's just that kind of player that's so much fun to watch, because, like you said, you never know what you're going to get. But you mentioned it. I thought he played really well in that game, which sounds crazy to say, but he was under constant duress. I think like every third snap was a pressure. Every fourth snap was a hit on the quarterback. And so he was basically just out there running for his life. And the top of his drop, basically, he had to get off the top of his drop almost every single snap once he got there, because the pass protection was so bad. And the Dolphins are now down a couple of offensive linemen for this game too, so we'll see what happens. But as far as what he was able to do, the extending of those plays and getting out on the edge of the pocket, you mentioned the downfield accuracy. He did hit that pass to Parker, which was really more about Parker going up over two defenders, but there was another shot up the sideline where he did get a one-on-one opportunity into the boundary with safety help rolling over to the field, and he took a shot and he put the ball right where it had to be. Parker just couldn't keep the feet in bounds. So he was really chucking the ball down the field. There was another chance to score a touchdown to Preston Williams, but the ball got separated very last minute. So I thought he played well. He had that one just horrible mistake where he put one up for Earl Thomas and he came down with it. That was a read I think that he was late on, but it also was kind of pushed late because of, like I said, the pressure that he received. So I think that the reason you have Fitzpatrick on the field right now is because Josh Rosen, just, we saw it in camp all throughout practice, he was just a beat late on everything. He wasn't able to, he'd make a check to see one side of the read, and he would determine that was covered up, and then you should be able to trust yourself to come back to your second read and let that thing fly. But he has to check that too, and that late beat with this offensive line against, in-season pressure packages compared to what the preseason will show you, it's not going to work. And it didn't work against the Ravens. He threw three passes, one got picked off. The offense looked somehow even worse with him on the field. So I think that when it comes to Rosen Fitzpatrick, right now Fitzpatrick is the only hope you have on this roster of giving the offense a fair evaluation, and that's what it's going to be. And until Rosen catches up from the mental side of things, I know you didn't ask about this, but until Rosen catches up, he's not going to get on the field, because this team just cannot support a quarterback who has to learn on the fly.
No, yeah, and really, that's a huge question, obviously, is why Josh Rosen isn't playing in these games. Forget exactly when the second Patriots-Dolphins game is. I think it's at the end of the season. I wouldn't be shocked if we see Rosen in that game, once the season kind of starts to be, wrap itself up. But I think you hit the nail on the head with Fitzmagic. Like, he has the capability. He's 2-9 in his career against the Patriots, but in both wins, it sounds horrible, but like, for a guy like him who hasn't necessarily been on great teams, it's honestly not that bad. There's other quarterbacks that, like, Andrew Luck's never beaten the Patriots, or never did beat the Patriots, I should say, past that. So, it's not as like crazy as it sounds. And in the two wins that he had, I remember the 2011 Buffalo win like it was yesterday, because I was up in college in upstate New York, surrounded by Bills fans when the game happened. But he threw for almost 400 yards in that game against the Patriots. And then he beat the Patriots in an overtime game as the Jets starting quarterback as he made his trip around the AFC East here. And I think that, he's capable of having those games, and he's had those games in the past against the Patriots. The way that I kind of summarized his performance on Sunday is that he was not the problem. He was certainly not the problem. The offensive line was, and that's where I kind of wanted to bring us to this next point. There was blown blocks. There was blown assignments. They coach in the middle of camp. Is that correct?
Yeah, at the fourth day of training camp, he was gone.
Oh man. So they've known that this has been a problem area of concern pretty much all of camp, I would think. And then trading your starting left tackle, who's one of the better up and coming players, is never, a good sign either.
It's been so strange with the way they've handled the entire offensive line, and it was never going to be good, even with Laremy Tunsil. And I made the argument that you trade Tunsil because, one, well, the Texans gave you a quarterback price tag for him, which to me, you just can't say no to that. And when it comes to maximizing the value of your roster, but even still, the offensive line was going to be trash because you can't win with one good offensive lineman. So I thought that was part of the plan of that trade, or I guess the plan that became that trade. But you know, they started off right after they fired Pat Flaherty. He had kind of his guys, it seemed like, and they had a lineup in place. One of those guys, a former Jaguar, and Chris Reed, and then he gets fired, and the lineup is completely brand new the very next day with Dave DeGuglielmo and Chris Reed, not one of those guys, despite the fact that, in my opinion, is one of the top three or four offensive linemen on this team, and he's still not on the field. So that's strange to me. But they went from that, the minute that DeGuglielmo was promoted to the job, to the offensive line job, they kept that same line all the way up through the Tunsil trade, which then obviously they had to change it, and they did. And then they get to the game on Sunday, and the right guard, who was his name is Shaq Dion Calhoun. He was an undrafted free agent. He was the starting right guard all through camp, and then he was deactivated on Sunday. So I don't know why. They traded for Danny Isadora, a former Hurricane. He started. He was just a disaster at right guard. And then they switched Jesse Davis, the right tackle, over to left tackle, a position that he hasn't played much in the pros. And so they have a change there. Julian Davenport, the new guy from Houston, comes in and plays right tackle. He was a left tackle in Houston, so they swapped those guys for some reason. I tend to think it's because they want to see if Davis can be a left tackle in the event they have a left-handed quarterback next year. That's a topic for another day. But the offensive line as a whole, just there's no push in the running game. They often get beat when they have to reach in the zone techniques. They often get pushed backwards and reset in gap techniques. The edge blocking against the pass rush is not there. There's no really good communication picking up stunts and games up front, which I know the Patriots are going to just overwhelm this offensive line with on Sunday. So I wish I could say something good about the group, but it's the 32nd lowest investment in the offensive line across the league, and it definitely shows.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, watching that Baltimore game, and I love watching Baltimore's defense.
They're awesome.
It's really well coached, and they have great pressure schemes up front. And they do some crazy things, like sending edge defenders all the way to play deep safety, and some crazy stuff, just rotating through coverages. And I think that the great thing about them is their pressures and their sim pressures up front, the way that they're designed is just fantastic. And the Patriots, actually, I don't know if it's the Ravens stealing from the Patriots or the Patriots stealing for the Ravens or them working together on them or whatever, but they're very similar, kind of schematically designed pressure packages in third down, third and longs, you know, passing situations. So if I'm the Dolphins, the only chance that I have on offense in this game is to stay ahead of the sticks. Like, if you get into third and eight against this Patriots defense, they're just going to do the same exact thing that Baltimore did and just run, you know, drop these guys off the edge and blitz these linebackers or blitz a safety or a slot corner or whatever the case may be. And it's going to be a ton of confusion for that offensive line. It wasn't just the fact that the Miami offensive line was obviously out-talented by the Baltimore front. The communication was also not very good either. And they really didn't pick up anything. I know Kenyon Drake got a poor pass protection grade by PFF, which I was actually surprised about, because he was out there like trying to like save diving across, like, you know, the formation to try to keep Fitzpatrick on his feet. So I actually thought that he made some really decent blocks, but I guess maybe they thought the whole kind of, you know, pie was not very good, even if there was a couple of individual good plays. But yeah, I think that's probably any area on this team, the offensive line is like the clear weakness of the whole thing. And you know, that I, speaking as somebody that has Dante Scarnecchia and those guys running the show up here, it's such an underrated part of what makes the Patriots so good, is having that strong foundation offensively. Let's talk about something that you can brag about a little bit. Positive. I wanted to talk about the receivers real quick. Specifically, Preston Williams, obviously, he's a rookie. He's kind of like, I compared him today a little bit to like your Jakobi Meyers. He's like a guy that broke out in training camp and is now, he's playing a lot more than Jakobi does in New England, just because of, you know, the receiving situations. But they have Preston Williams. We all know about Devontae Parker. He's been in the matchup for long enough at this point. It sounds like Albert Wilson's not going to play, which is kind of a bummer, because I actually really like watching him play. But I actually think that this skill group is not bad. It's not I don't think it's the worst or anywhere close to the worst in the NFL. They got some receivers. We know what Kenyon Drake can do. Jakeem Grant's a nice gadget player and brings that speed element to the offense. But I wanted to ask you specifically about Preston Williams and just what you've seen from him.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you that this actually is like a middle of the road, probably a little bit low or lower than average type of skill group the Dolphins have. And it does start with, like you mentioned, the bigger bodies right now. Preston Williams and Devontae Parker were kind of the two focal points in the offense. And Preston Williams was a guy that basically showed up the first day of OTAs and caught everybody's attention by snatching those high point balls and running along the end line for touchdown or goal line drills and catching touchdowns. We saw him catch one in his NFL debut on Sunday. Along the end line there with a great release and stack of the defensive back. But he's just kind of been doing that all throughout training camp. He has those really quiet hands at the catch point. And I think it was the do your job number three where Belichick was talking to Gronkowski about his quiet hands. And it was something that Gronk had just kind of learned later in his career. Preston Williams is really good at that, stacking the defensive back, showing those quiet hands, and letting the ball kind of travel before he makes the catch. So he's been really impressive. I think that he is one of the lifelines for Dolphins fans to watch this team this year, and hopefully he can continue to develop and progress and kind of push that receiver need away because there are so many other needs on this roster and just make that go away for the offseason. That'd be a big win. Albert Wilson, I'm not sure what his future here holds because he got hurt early last year. He's hurt now again. It just doesn't seem like he's long for the future. Jakeem Grant has a new contract. He's been criminally underused in his entire career. We'll see if he gets a little bit more action. He did play like 30 snaps on Sunday, but I think he could be your kind of, your Cordell Patterson, Philip Dorsett, Julian Edelman package all into one guy who can, take the jet sweep handoff, run vertical routes, catch the screen passes, and do some work in the underneath passing game as well.
Yeah, I like Grant. I think, he also obviously is good in the kicking game as well. And Josh McDaniels and O'Shea are two guys that really kind of pride themselves on winning matchups and being able to, get linebackers matched up on guys like Grant or get safeties matched up on guys like Grant and win those matchups one-on-one. And I think he can be a guy like that. If you get Grant somehow matched up on one of these Patriots linebackers, who I do really like, but I don't know if they're going to be able to keep up with him, as most, middle linebackers are not going to be able to keep up with a guy like Jakeem Grant. I agree with you 100%, though. Their skill group is not the issue either, along kind of with Fitzmagic. I wish that if they had a better offensive line, I actually think this offense would not be horrible. It's just that O-line is probably going to bring them down to, the bottom of the pack. But I wanted to end by moving back over to the defensive side of the ball. I actually thought, after watching the tape, that this was kind of just a game from hell for this Miami defense, where they missed a lot of tackles. The tackling, I think, was the biggest thing that I looked at that I know is driving Flores absolutely nuts, because you got to be able to tackle in this league. Having a guy like Hollywood Brown just break a tackle and go 80 yards for a touchdown on a little slant is not something that you want to have happen all the time. But where do you think the Miami defense does go from here? And specifically, what have you seen from Minka Fitzpatrick? Because he did not have a very good week one. And I feel like all summer long I heard about him not really loving his role in this Flores defense.
Which is really strange, and we'll get back into that here in just one second. But one of my biggest pet peeves in this entire game that we cover here, Evan, is that the misunderstanding for modern day defenses and dime packages and three safety looks. And every single offseason, I tell Dolphins fans this team needs reinforcements at safety, because you've got Rashad Jones, he's great down in the box. You had TJ McDonald, that's what he does well. And they're trying to kind of force Minka Fitzpatrick into the strong safety role. And they rotate Bobby McCain back to the free safety position, a spot he's never played before. He's 185 pounds. He doesn't run all that well. So he's kind of on the short end back there as well, relying purely on instincts and the coverage calls to get himself in the right position. But he looked like a first-time safety in that game. He was taking the cheese on some of those zone read looks that Lamar Jackson was doing, bailing out the cover zero, like you mentioned, and trying to come up and run support. And then all of a sudden you've got 10 defenders because he's defending grass, basically. But as far as Minka goes, it's such a weird situation, and really the thing that I'm monitoring closely the most, closest this season, because like I said, wins aren't the thing that matters, but I want to see about these young guys and how they develop. And Minka had issues with the coaching staff last year, and that I understood. That was justified, because Matt Burke, for all intents and purposes, probably didn't belong in the role that he was given from Adam Gase as Dolphins defensive coordinator. They set records every year he was here, 2 years that he was here, for points and yards allowed. So he, you know, you can take that criticism for what you will. It's probably warranted. But then Minkah Fitzpatrick comes back this year and says that, you know, the whole situation with his mom, where it's like, well, he's not playing the right position. That's weird. Then you come back and he's got an issue after this game saying that, you know, we had some situations where we weren't in the right position for coverage, but also we got to do better when we have the opportunity. So he took some accountability, but also pushed some of the blame off on the coaching staff. And, you know, Evan, I spent all offseason studying the Patriots defense, trying to figure out what I'm getting myself into here. And I loved it. If, you know, if we're going to apply the same principles and the same concepts, I'm thinking, great, this is one of the best schemes in football. And that's a great fit for Minkah Fitzpatrick, because he can play free safety. He can play star corner. He can play outside corner. He can do so many things. But he's out here playing 45-something snaps. 12 of those reps are as a slot corner. That's not excusable to me, because that's his best position, where he was actually like the number one PFF slot cornerback last year as far as passer rating allowed. So I want to see him get more of a defined role, play inside. He's not a perimeter corner. He's not really a deep third or you know, a deep single high or a deep, you know, half type of safety. I think that he's the kind of guy that can excel in man coverage, take away your tight ends, take away your slot receivers, and help in the running game that way. So we'll see. I that's my biggest thing I'm watching this Sunday on defense, is what Minkah Fitzpatrick does. Do they change his role, or do they kind of keep going this direction that he's clearly not happy with?
Yeah, because the interesting thing about what you just said is that you described a player that's a lot like Patrick Chung.
And yeah, exactly.
It's that kind of hybrid defensive back role, where he's playing a little bit as a nickel corner, or he's playing in the box as like almost a linebacker, essentially, and playing, you know, the strong safety most of the time. The Patriots really don't use Chung very much at all in free safety role as like a single high player or something like that. He sometimes will drop and play a little bit of half field, but only in certain circumstances when they want to play that kind of zone for whatever reason, you know, if it's third and 20 or something like that. And really no wide corner really for Chung at all, unless he's manned on a tight end and they bring the tight end outside. And that's, you know, just kind of the formation or the alignment by the offense. I've always looked at Minkah and said, you know, he should be playing the Patrick Chung role in the Miami defense. And nowadays, hybrid players are so highly sought after. Like, that's what every coach wants, is a hybrid defensive back that they can move all around the secondary. And then guys like a Kyle Van Noy or Dante Hightower that can play both off the ball and on the ball linebacker. Those are like kind of the two biggest roles right now that are, you know, these new roles, these new hybrid roles. So yeah, I'm really interested to see what happens with Minkah, because we all obviously love his talent. Like, we know how good he is at football. It's just a matter of schematically and assignment based figuring out where they're going to put him. What do you think the likelihood that this game is close on Sunday?
What's the likelihood of me winning the lottery? I mean, I just don't see it, Evan. I wish we could say, like, oh, they'll give him a good game and the Dolphins will come up short by a field goal or something. But like you said, unless there's a, you know, that tropical storm hits and then it turns into a slop fest, that's probably the only way it happens. But just the talent at every single position, the Patriots seem to have the Dolphins trumped. And so you have that with the, you know, the student versus the teacher, so to speak. I don't see where the advantages are. Maybe the fact that that is a house of horrors for the Patriots. Maybe the fact that the Dolphins, even with the loss last week, since they put the canopy on Hard Rock Stadium, they're 16-7 at home. So that's what we've got going for us, I suppose. But it's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, that, you know, the protege thing, though, is interesting, because Belichick has had some, you know, blips in the radar against some of his old proteges. Last year with Matt Patricia, Eric Mangini beat Belichick. So there, Josh McDaniels actually beat Belichick his first year in Denver also. So there is some kind of, you know, there is something to that. And a lot of Patriots fans also are conspiracy theorists. I shouldn't even call them Patriots fans. A lot of conspiracy theorists think that Belichick gave Matt Patricia the game last year because of how much trouble Matt Patricia was having in the Detroit media about how horrible of a season. I don't think that actually happened. That's 100% a conspiracy theory, but you know, you never know. Maybe Belichick keeps this game. I can guarantee you this. There'll be no fake punts up 30 points.
Oh my goodness.
That will not happen. Belichick has way too much respect for Flores and for O'Shea and all those guys to pull any of that. That was, the Patriots have done some stuff to stomp on people's throats before. Trust me, I'm not going to sit here and say that they're like a moral high ground for that sort of thing. But that in particular, I don't think I've ever would see the Patriots do that. Now, back in 07, they would send Randy Moss on a 65-yard, you know, post route and still throw bombs up 30 points in the fourth quarter. But I don't think I've ever seen them run a fake punt. What was the score, like 49-3 or 49-10 or something like that?
Yeah, I think it was 42-something. And it, to be perfectly honest, even though I was on the short end of it, I love that mentality. Like, you know, let's play football for 60 minutes. So,
yeah.
But you're right. I totally agree that Belichick has way too much respect for Flores to do that.
Yeah, Travis, anything you want to tease or let anybody know where they can follow you, and if you got anything they want to, you want them to read also?
I do have a Dolphins-Patriots preview up on LockedOnDolphins.com if you guys want to check that out from a Dolphins perspective, kind of scouting, you know, the Patriots team, what you guys might do to Miami. Every Sunday night, my flagship show is the recap show, and then, of course, the Sunday through Friday podcast every day on Locked On Dolphins.
Awesome. The Locked On, the entire podcast network, the Patriots Locked On Patriots is really good. Locked On Dolphins is awesome. You guys all do a great job. And I keep on blanking on when the second game is, but we're going to do this again. And maybe it will be a little bit happier times for the Dolphins. You never know. I mean, well, I'm not going to never say never.
Hey, you guys could be playing for home field. We could be playing for Tua, so let's do it.
Sounds good. I'm really looking forward to having all the young quarterbacks against Brady. I think that that would be awesome. And to get to see Tua twice a year would be really cool, too. So I'm all on board with that. Travis, thank you so much, man.
Appreciate it, Evan.
I want to thank our guest, Travis Wingfield, once again. Again, go follow Travis at Wingfield NFL, one of the best minds on Twitter for X's and O's, and the Miami Dolphins, who, like I said, the Patriots do face twice a year. This podcast has been powered by betonline.ag. Go to betonline.ag and use the promo code CLNS50 for a welcome bonus. A minimum of $55 deposit is required, and please read the rules and conditions into your welcome bonus on the BetOnline website. Again, that's betonline.ag. Adam and I will be back next week. We will break down this Miami Dolphins game. We'll also have plenty to say, I'm sure, about Antonio Brown. But signing off, thanking my guest once again, Travis Wingfield. I'm Evan Lazar. Thanks for listening.